You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll meet an 11-year-old from La Crosse who's made a big splash in the world of crochet. Now, Governor Evers says he's going to do something Wisconsin hasn't seen in almost a decade, grant pardons. During Governor Walker's 8 years in office, he said the appeals process is adequate and that he wasn't going to override that system. As a result, he didn't issue any pardons. Yesterday, Evers told Madison TV station WKOW that certain people convicted of felonies deserve a fresh start.
People will be able to apply, and the board will make recommendations. I think it's important. I think most people in the state understand that people are going to be rehabilitated. They need a second chance, and so this gives people the second chance.
Mark Osler is the Robert and Marion Short Professor of Law at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
Can you give us the basics on what it means to pardon someone?
Yeah, the pardon power generally covers two different things. And one is a commutation of sentence, where the governor or president will have the ability to shorten a sentence that's being served, but it doesn't affect the underlying conviction. The second thing is a pardon, and that's something that is going to very often be given after a person has completed their sentence, and it's going to remove some of the effects of the conviction itself.
I know it varies from state to state, but what are some of those effects of a felony conviction that would still affect someone even after they complete their sentence?
Sure. It's going to affect your right to vote in some places. It's going to affect your right to possess a firearm, whether or not you can serve on a jury. And importantly, it's going to limit, in a lot of places, your ability to get certain kinds of jobs. Even as a barber, in some places you'll be limited if you have a felony conviction.
Now, we had our previous governor, Scott Walker, saying from the start he wasn't going to issue pardons. He held to that. He didn't convene a pardon committee along the way. Is that unusual? Is that something we've seen before in other states?
No, that's unusual. And, Governor Walker, in his description of it, which is, the criminal justice system gets things right, he was misunderstanding some of the fundamental reasons that we have clemency at all. And one of them is a second chance to look at someone, whether they're still in prison or whether they're out, and look for rehabilitation and try to use mercy, the clemency power, to let them rebuild their lives.
Can you talk a little bit about the history of how pardons came to be in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, they're ancient. And, of course, they go back to the earliest legal codes, actually. In England, it was the power of the king and the king alone. And that's one of the things that's unusual about it being imported in the United States and in the Constitution, is that it does allow one of the powers of kings to rest in the hand of the executive. But there was that choice by the framers of the Constitution, and the states followed, although the methods that they use vary quite a bit. But in a state like Wisconsin, you have the governor having a similar power to what the president was given by the framers of the Constitution.
Talking to Mark Osler, law professor at the University of St. Thomas in Minneapolis, about pardons here in Wisconsin. Governor Walker didn't issue any. Governor Evers has said, he's going to use that power of the governor. Yeah, one unusual thing about the pardons is the criminal justice system is in the judicial branch all the way along, and then this pardon option is in the executive branch. That is kind of an odd duck.
Yeah, it is, and but it's appropriate, too, in that it doesn't work very well if we leave it in the hands of prosecutors, because they're not so good at admitting that they didn't get things exactly right the first time. And we've seen that in the federal system, that in the past several decades, the Department of Justice has really captured the clemency system there. And unless there's a real forceful action by the president, as we saw at the end of President Obama's term, we haven't seen much clemency action since it was captured by the prosecutors. So the independence of the executive is really important if this tool of second chance and mercy is to mean anything.
There was just a change in Wisconsin's pardon law. The lame duck session in December was signed into law by Governor Walker. One of the changes that didn't get a lot of attention, now the governor has to report any pardons or whether his aides release anyone from prison early and then keep track of recidivism if anybody who's pardoned commits a new crime. Is that a big change? Is that a big deal?
It shouldn't be. That's transparency. Those are things that we probably wouldn't have a problem with tracking anyways, to know what the recidivism is of people who receive clemency. I realize that the purpose was probably to embarrass future governors who might use the power. But the thing is, you know, the discussion on clemency too often is driven by anecdotes, too, that if you have one person who commits a crime after they receive clemency, that makes the whole system come into question, when really what we need to do is look at it compared to the population of prisoners who are released as a whole. And what we see when we look at that generally is that the rates of recidivism are better or not worse than the comparison group.
Are there enough cases to make a valid comparison? I assume the population of people who have been pardoned or gotten clemency is much smaller than the general post-prison population.
It is. It is. It's a lot smaller. And so, we can look at similar things, especially if we're talking about cases of early release. That's where it really gets controversial. But one of the good studies we have is by the U.S. Sentencing Commission, where they changed a guideline that allowed a lot of people who had been convicted of trafficking and crack cocaine got out earlier than they would have otherwise. And they measured their recidivism rate against people who served their full term and found that there was no substantial difference between the recidivism rates.
Now, here in Wisconsin, I know the system isn't so much that the governor goes out and seeks out people who have had felony convictions to pardon. They have to apply. They have to go through this pardon board, and then the governor ultimately reviews that. Is that a pretty common practice in states around the country?
It is. It is. And, you know, it's interesting, too, about the pardon board itself. You know, that didn't exist until 1980 when Governor Dreyfus created it. The Constitution just gives the power to the governor. But it can be a good idea to have a board if you've got good, responsible people on it. I mean, for one thing, it gives some political cover to the governor for the decisions that he or she makes. And they can do the investigation into the petitions that are put forward, too. So it'll be interesting to see who ends up being on that board.
And do we have a sense of what kinds of convictions ultimately, or people who have had particular types of convictions end up being pardoned?
Well, people who get pardons after they've completed their sentence tend to range the gamut, although it's, you know, obviously more common for lower level crimes than higher level ones. For people who are given a commutation, you also see that all over the place, and you know, with fair degrees of success. Even people who have had violent felonies 30 years later or even less than that sometimes have substantially changed their lives to the point where it is reasonable to release them, and that's turned out to be the right call when they are released.
We'll leave it there for now. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
I've been talking to Mark Osler. He's the Robert and Marion Short Professor of Law at the University of St. Thomas. That's in Minneapolis. We talked with him about Governor Evers' announcement that he would use his power as governor to grant pardons and commute sentences. Governor Walker had said from the outset he wouldn't do that, and he didn't do that in his 8 years in office. Coming up, La Crosse is home to a kid many are calling a crochet prodigy. We'll talk to Jonah Larson about how he discovered his passion for crochet and his success in the international crochet scene. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk with an 11-year-old from La Crosse whose crochet projects have captured the hearts and minds of people around the world. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a visit to the arcade.
Like many children of the 80s and 90s, Hilton Jones grew up playing pinball. His favorite machine, the Addams Family, brings about an air of nostalgia to days when kiddie cocktails, a basket of day-old popcorn, and a stack of quarters were all a person needed to get lost in the world of flippers, multiballs, and free games. As adults living in Madison, Hilton and his wife Heidi are tapping into that nostalgia, spreading their love for pinball to others in the Madison community.
I'm Hilton. I'm one of the three co-founders of Madison Pinball.
I'm Heidi. I'm not directly involved with Madison Pinball, but I do support it, and I play a lot of pinball.
And then Heidi also is a founding member of Bells and Chimes. Heidi and I specifically collect rare games that were made in the 80s or early 90s and you don't find as often. We like having those so that when we have friends over, we have games that they've never even played before. I think there's a lot of nostalgia. But I also think everyone's glued to their phones. And arcades are that nostalgia, but also that opportunity to come have a beer and socialize and put away the phone. And pinball specifically, right, it's a physical game. Every game changes, it's unique, and you can cheer each other on. So it's a lot of fun to have that social experience, to do it together. There's a lot of gamers out there, and if you think, you know, a lot of 30-year-olds, people who are at bars drinking, right, grew up in the video game age. I grew up in Belvidere, Illinois in the 90s, and pinball was pretty big in the 90s, and I played a lot of Addams Family Pinball, which is my favorite pinball of all time, still my favorite pinball of all time. And the collecting side and the rebuilding and the playing side happened postgraduate school.
I grew up in Texas, so not as close to the pinball manufacturing mecca of Chicago, so did not really play a lot of pinball till I met Hilton in graduate school. Played a couple tables here and there, and I realized that it's a good sport, in quotation marks, for people who are super competitive.
Like any sport, it's all about practice, but there are lots of videos, so you can watch online and see flipper techniques, you know, how to trap a ball, how to aim, how to control. Or you can do the most common thing you should do, but no one does, is read the rule card, which is on every single game, on the apron of it, and it will give you the general idea of what you should do on the game.
Or you just try not to drain the ball between the flippers.
Shoot the blinky light. A lot of people, they really get into pinball when they start to realize that it's kind of like a board game. There's objectives, there's a rule set, there's a strategy of what you're shooting for. Instead of just trying to keep the ball in play, you're actually aiming for a shot.
What I feel most proud about as far as playing was there's a big tournament in Pittsburgh every year that has like 840 something people called Pinburg. And this past year, I qualified in the A division and qualified in place 62 out of 843 people, and that's against the top pinball people in the world.
I'm continually amazed. You know, I lived through the 90s when it was really popular. In the 90s, in Belvidere, Illinois, a little podunk town, every spot had a pinball machine, the Hub Cigar Store and every restaurant, and that died out. And it's really neat to see it come back. I don't know where it stops or if it does stop. I mean, I'm sure it's cyclical, but everything seems to be going up from here.
And the other side of that, too, is not only are people becoming more interested in it, there's also more manufacturers coming into the picture. One of them actually is local to Wisconsin. Spooky Pinball is based in Benton, Wisconsin, and they've come out with a couple games. And I think just the wide variety of people and companies manufacturing pins is also helping grow the popularity of pinball.
I think we've taken ownership of it. I mean, I'm proud to say I'm a pinhead.
Why, thank you, Bing.
That story came to us from WPR's Jenny Peek. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, at 11 years old, Jonah Larson of La Crosse does what a lot of kids his age do. He goes to school, plays sports, and hangs out with his friends. But Jonah is also famous in the textile world for the works of art he creates by crocheting. And he has a huge and growing fan base online. Jonah Larson joins us now to talk about what got him into crochet and some of his favorite projects. Jonah, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for asking me to talk to you.
Well, Jonah, how did you first get into crochet?
I first started to crochet when I was 5, and I found a crochet hook in a bag of crafts. And my mom helped find a tutorial on YouTube about it because she has no idea how to crochet. And from that first tutorial, I made a dishcloth.
I saw a picture of that dishcloth. I was really impressed. How do you feel about that first product you made?
Now when I'm 11, I look back at it and say, wow, those stitches are even.
Okay, so it was a pretty good first effort, right?
Yeah, I'm really proud of that first dishcloth.
Now you've made, do you have any idea how many things you've made since then?
Hundreds.
Now what is it that you liked as a 5-year-old, still now as an 11-year-old, what do you like about crochet?
Well, at the start when I was 5, it was because the hook was shiny. And now it's because it relaxes me and because it makes other people happy to see my work and it makes me happy.
And have you gone to competitions with your crochet?
Yes, I do enter things in the La Crosse State Fair and I've won quite a few ribbons from that.
Now, are there other people your age doing this at the state fair?
Yes, there are other
kids
doing it.
There are some. Okay. Yeah. And what have your friends said about your love of crochet?
They're really supportive, and they say I'm really fast. And they do request hats, scarves, mittens, and a few even ask for T-shirts with my Jonas Hands logo on them.
So describe your logo. What does that look like?
It says Jonas Hands at the bottom, and then it has a handprint of both of my hands together, and then it's just Jonas Hands at the bottom.
And you've put things up on social media and the internet, right? Where do you display your work?
At my Instagram page, Jonah Hands, and on my Facebook page.
I understand people now from around the world have commissioned projects for you. What kind of things have people asked for?
A very common request is my braided cowl. That's a very common one.
A braided cowl?
Yeah.
So that's just like a cowl that somebody would wear?
Uh-huh. Just kind of like a scarf that you wear around your neck.
And do people request particular colors for that?
Yeah, they choose their colors.
I also saw people are sending you materials now.
Yes, that now it's happening like 4 times a week. It's very common. They send me ergonomically made crochet hooks with my name inscribed in the bottom, different yarns to try, new crochet hooks, and just a wide variety of things.
What's it like to know you have fans, not just in your community, but around the world who are following your work?
It's really enjoyable to know that other people really like to see what I make. I enjoy that feeling.
I understand that some older people who do crochet are worried that younger generations aren't picking it up. Are they excited to see somebody who's 5 and now 11 doing this?
Yes, that's another reason they're very supportive. And they want to carry this on, and I want to carry this fiber art on to the next generation.
You watched that YouTube video to get started. What else have you done over the years to learn and master your craft?
To master my craft, I just experiment with different things. And I kind of put 2 different projects together and see what I can do.
Talk about some of your more creative projects. What kind of things have you done?
Probably my stuffed octopus or my snake. Those are quite creative, as in how you could make it look different and look like the actual animal.
Yeah, when I think of crochet, I guess I first think of a quilt, something that's flat and two-dimensional. Is it a lot harder to make something like that octopus or I guess the cowl, where it's three-dimensional?
No, not really. It's kind of the same concept.
Now, do you work from a pattern when you try to do something new, or do you just make it up as you go?
Sometimes I work from a pattern, and sometimes I start with a pattern, but then I deviate from it and make my own little twists, and sometimes I don't use a pattern at all.
Our producer, JC, sent me a picture of what she says is her favorite project of yours. It was this big quilt, and I think you'd made it all out of scraps, so it's just a billion different colors. Can you talk about that one a little?
Yeah, that one I made when I was 7 or 8, and I had all these little yarn scraps in a big tote, and they were piling up. And my mom wanted me to do something with it, and I told her just to wait. And then she's like, okay, now you have to do something with it. And I decided I was just going to grab 3 balls at a time and use a quite big hook and just crochet all of it together and use up all of it.
Describe your house. How much of your house is taken over by crochet supplies and works in progress?
Well, I only have 3 works in progress at a time.
Okay.
Lots of crocheters have a ton, and then they just stay in totes, and they don't finish them. I only let myself have 2 or 3, and I have to finish one before I move on to the next one.
Oh, that's really smart. So you don't end up with that thing in the corner that you just never finish.
Yep, that I don't like that.
Have you started teaching other people how to do crochet now?
No, not yet, but I've taught a few kids at school how to do a few simple stitches just to get them started.
And are they into it? Do they, when they try it, do they get, pardon the pun, hooked?
Yeah, they do.
People think of kids on their smartphones and devices all the time. How would you sell doing crochet, using that to do something with your hands, as opposed to being on a smartphone?
I just think of it as a more productive way to spend your childhood.
Do you have any other hobbies apart from crochet?
Yes, I do. I'm very well-rounded. I am in cross-country basketball, play with my brother, my siblings, have family time, which is important, and yeah.
And are you hoping to make money by crocheting over the years?
I already do a lot of that.
Okay. Are you setting money away for college?
I do four things with the money I earn. I save some for retirement and college, spend some on myself now, invest some back into my hobby, and most importantly, donate some.
Oh, what kind of things do you donate your crochet earnings to?
Well, I gave some of my items to a nonprofit organization called Roots Ethiopia, and they auctioned my things, and they raised $400 for the same region where I was adopted from.
And before we wrap up, Jonah, you said you usually have about three projects going. Can you tell us what your works in progress are right now?
Right now, I am working on a larksfoot afghan in a blue, variegated blue, green, and white, and a cream. And I'm also working on one of my braided cowls, which is in order. And I am in the middle of creating my own pattern and my own cowl pattern.
Wow. And I read that you got so many commissions, you had to stop taking commissions for a while. People are listening. They might think, oh, I want to commission something. Should they hold off for now, or are you taking commissions?
We've had like 3,500 orders, so it's still shut down for now because I only have two hands.
All right. I will not commission something from you then right now, Jonah. Thank you so much for coming to the studio and taking the time today.
Well, thank you for calling me.
Jonah Larson is a student from La Crosse who is recognized worldwide as an expert at crochet. He joined us to talk about how he got into the craft. Coming up, there are concerns about teacher morale, and schools are having a hard time filling positions in some cases. A guest says Democrats and Republicans have both hurt the teaching profession and that we need to make some major changes. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on the morning show, Kate Archer Kent talks to a relationship columnist and gets some Valentine's Day advice for couples. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, we've heard in the news lately that many Wisconsin schools are having trouble finding and retaining teachers and that fewer college students are going into the teaching profession in Wisconsin and around the country. Our next guest says he's not surprised. He says education reformers from both parties have created a hostile work environment for teachers and hurt the teacher training process along the way. Tim Slecker is the dean of the School of Education at Edgewood College in Madison. He's a founding member of Education Deans for Justice and Equity and the past president of the Wisconsin Independent Colleges of Teacher Education. Tim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No problem, man. Thanks.
Well, we've got this news about teacher shortage,
right?
People not going into teaching. You've got thoughts. What do you see as the cause here?
First of all, recognize teacher shortage, and people will say we have a teacher shortage because we can't hire people. And I would say there are some areas, special education in the rural parts, where we actually have true shortages. But the idea to look at across the state and call the entire phenomena a teacher shortage really takes away from the reality of what's actually happening. I heard you talk about this. We actually have a retention issue. We have more teachers leaving the field than there are entering to become field. We have less teachers going into teaching. We have less students going into teaching. So why? And that's what I'm trying to push people for the past 4 years. Instead of looking at this as a simple labor issue and or a licensing issue, you know, the other licensing gets in the way of getting good teachers. No, it actually doesn't get in the way. In fact, deregulating the licensing to let people into teaching is actually harmful to kids because you're sending less qualified people in front of children. The other problem with that, though, is that it doesn't address the issue of even if you send more teachers out there, if they leave in 1 to 3 years, which is about the lifespan of a new teacher right now, who cares? You're just simply supplying cannon fodder for the real problem, which is the system, and it's actually a 35-year system, of accountability, test-based punish accountability that has, quote, been blaming teachers for the achievement gap, for low standards, whatever you want to say. But we've had a movement, and as you said, both parties, whether it's No Child Left Behind from Bush, whether it's Race to the Top from Obama, ESSA, which was the new thing, all of these, quote, ways to hold teachers accountable are actually ways that are driving teachers out of the field.
So take us into the classroom now. You got this new teacher, years 1 to 3. What are the things going on in their lives as teachers that's making them say, all right, I'm out?
The biggest thing when you talk about this is that they're let's put this out there. We don't have a shortage problem. We have a teacher demoralization problem. It's been documented. Actually, Dora Santoro, college professor at Bowdoin, wrote the book Demoralized, where she lays out the research that says we don't have a shortage. We have a demoralization. And the biggest issue, get to your question, is the lack of autonomy and lack of respect as a first-year teacher going out there and being handheld, fed a curriculum, told to stay on, you know, task with the curriculum, and then constantly being reminded about their biggest issue is to raise test scores instead of creating meaningful, lasting, deep relationships with children that actually encourage them to learn. So teachers will tell me, Tim, I'm actually being told to do things that are harmful to kids. Miss recess, keep them in at lunch, skip art, no science, all of these things in the pursuit of this ridiculous achievement gap that actually now, 35 years later, is still exactly where it was all this time. And so we've got teachers leaving. Nobody's going into teaching. We've got an achievement gap that's been going on perfectly. We've measured it wonderfully. If we could say anything the past 35 years has done well, is we can without a doubt say we've measured the achievement gap. Stop measuring the achievement gap. Let teachers teach. They are absolutely demoralized by the fact that they are being asked a lot of times as teachers, when they talk to me privately, will say, I'm actually being threatened sometimes that I need to be in compliance with teaching standards that are going to be on the test, because if our test scores don't go up, we're going to be in trouble.
Have we gotten any benefit, apart from measurement, have we gotten any benefit from this idea that, hey, we need to test to know how well our students doing, to know how well our students or our teachers are teaching? Has education been improved in any way by that?
Education-related companies that supply products to that issue have done great. It's been a boon industry for testing, Pearson, you name that. As for has it done anything, people say, we need this to, where you're going, we need this to show the gaps. Actually, we have what's called the National Assessment of Education Progress, which is a test that is given a random sample every so many years that's been going on since the 60s. Guess what it shows? We knew we had an achievement gap back then. So the idea that we need more tests, that we need state tests, that we need local tests, that we need individual tests to point out the gaps were always there. They've always been there. They're not hidden. So we already have a national, and in fact, it's a better test because it's a sampling with low stakes that doesn't get people fired and doesn't have kids shaking in their beds the night before about the test they have to take.
Talking to Tim Slecker, Dean of the School of Education at Edgewood College in Madison. He says we have big problems in the way we approach education lately, and we need big changes. Let's talk about teacher training now. That's also a big concern for you.
Teacher education.
Right. Can you talk about different things?
We train animals.
Okay.
We educate teachers.
Point taken. Okay. Talk about what you see wrong with teacher education. Maybe it's that we call it teacher training.
Well, what's wrong with teacher education? You asked me to criticize my own field. I right now, the biggest issue with teacher education is in one way the same issues that public schools are facing and public teachers are facing, is that the pushing down from above by bureaucratic people of what we now have to, quote, teach in teacher education to, quote, meet the standards. And so, again, a deprofessionalization of teacher education. And so my colleagues, you gotta say, you know, we have PhDs. We've taught for 5, 15, 25 years in classrooms. You know, to come out and now say, here's what you need to teach future teachers, that's, again, that's disrespectful at best. It's the same thing that happens to teachers. So what's wrong with teacher education? The biggest issue is the disrespect that teacher education itself gets. If you talk to students who go through teacher education, one of the complaints might be more so is that when they get out into the classroom, they find a conflict of what was taught in the teacher education classes and what they're being mandated to do. That is an issue. However, I would say the issue is the mandate of what they're being asked to do once they leave teacher education, as opposed to continuing with what we started in teacher education, which was a deep sense of teaching for justice and equity.
Talk about that idea, teaching for justice and equity.
Yeah, right. It's totally different than teaching for test scores. And I know people would say, look, if the test scores matched up, that would be for justice and equity. No, actually, you know, it's not. Looking at tests, first of all, understanding that we would, from a teaching for justice and equity, I might step up and go, you know what, I'm not going to give this test today right now because it's inappropriate. It doesn't measure what it's supposed to do. And in fact, it's going to be used, the data from that test is going to be used to label our school failing, close it, and then charterize or run it over through a private. So a just and equity approach to a teacher would be a teacher leader who understands why that is a problem. What else was
Just the idea of teaching for justice and equity.
Yeah. I mean, the recognition of, you know, we just got finished with the National Teaching for Black Lives Week. The idea that we come at and teach a rich, justice-oriented curriculum that exposes students to the realities and the truths and some of the nastiness of the system of which we actually go. I mean, the public school system itself, what are the systems of racism and oppression that are there? So there's so much in a racial justice equity driven curriculum that is not being taught. And when you force mandate closing the achievement gap through reading and math scores, you actually push out justice and equity teaching.
Some people will hear that and say, this sounds like a sort of political indoctrination in teaching.
Is it political indoctrination? Public schools are the foundation of democracy. We have to admit that. So the idea that we have 85%+ of the population in public schools, and the reality is that while you end up going to school and hopefully get a good job because you got a good education, the foundation of public education is to create informed, critical citizens. If that's political indoctrination, then I'm sorry, then I guess that's what we're doing. But the idea that we're going to have kids leaving schools with political action ideas, with wanting to be a part of democracy, that's what's left out of the curriculum. And I'm that's intentional. We create a complacent group of voters. And we actually, think about this, we elevate voting as if that's some type of civic action that we need to be proud about, instead of looking at what are the demonstrations going on? What is happening? How do we look critically at the structures of society? Public schools were founded from the idea that they are a bedrock of democracy. That's their first purpose. Dewey said it. You have to have a democracy. Jefferson said it too. I mean, let's go back to the public understanding of why we have public schools. It's so that we have awesome citizens that don't allow stupid things to occur in their lives.
We're talking to Tim Slecker, Dean of the School of Education at Edgewood College in Madison. We're talking about, our starting point was Wisconsin's teacher retention problem, why fewer people are going into the profession and staying there. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you're an educator or have been. What do you think about what our guest is saying? Do you see problems retaining teachers in your part of the state? What do you think of what our guest is saying about the role of public education training citizens for a democracy. What do you think of testing? Lots of testing in our schools. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up a conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Tim Slecker, Dean of the School of Education at Edgewood College in Madison, about what it's like to be a teacher in schools in Wisconsin and around the nation right now. He writes about issues in the teaching world at BustedPencils.com. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you seeing in our schools as a parent, a student yourself, an educator, an administrator? What has changed over the years? If you're teaching, are you seeing lots of testing, as our guest says, getting in the way of actual education? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Annette is with us in Appleton. Annette, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
I'm a teacher, and I think that to say that the demoralization of teachers is about testing is an oversimplification. I think that we see some the measurements is frustrating sometimes, but I think that the Act 10 and the devilification of teachers here in the state did a lot for demoralization, and the public perception or respect for teachers is still not back there. And I think teachers struggle with that a lot more than they do, at least at the secondary level with testing, where, you know, it's just one test that really we're looking at. And ACT has helped a lot because that's an actual test that students are using in their future. So.
Annette, thanks for the call. So Act 10, she says, and the vilification of teachers is part of the
morale problem. I'm not going to disagree with that, but understand that Act 10, all of these are part of a long, as I said, you have to look at this as a 35-year progression that starts at actually a nation at risk, which was the wonderful document put up by the Reagan administration in 1983 that essentially said schools are failing. And that movement, so Act 10, absolutely, is part of that attack on teachers, attack on. And it's not simply, quote, testing. Understand, though, when I talk about it, people really reduce it, a system of accountability, surveillance, and monitoring, Act 10, yes, all of those issues, no respect. But again, I said this before, though, too, autonomy, to be a professional teacher and make decisions based on what you know is best, that stripping of autonomy that came with Act 10, that comes with the system of accountability, typically ranks as one of the biggest issues, on top of the fact that oversized classrooms, not enough supplies, not enough money, throw all that together, and guess what? Teachers are leaving the field. Why would anybody want to be a teacher?
Annette, thanks for the call. Going out to John in Madison. John, hi.
Hi. I just want to say I was looking into going into teaching about 15 years ago. I'm a scientist with a chemistry degree, lots of math and physics. In industry, even at that time, I can make six figures. Going into teaching at that time, I think the salaries were around $35,000 an hour. So when I found that out, it was not even an option anymore. And I wouldn't be in the position I'm in today. I wouldn't have the degree I have unless I would have had excellent teachers. And so I think the money issue is huge as well. It was what kept me out of teaching.
John, thanks for the call.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, as we look at the teachers over the past, 10 years actually in Wisconsin now make less money than they did 10 years ago, right? You know, what's happening in Denver right now? What just finished in Los Angeles? What happened last year with all the red states? I mean, recognizing that the pay doesn't keep up. But you know, I liked what the other point, though, about great teachers and how important they are. When you approach a teacher shortage from trying to figure out how to get people into the classroom as fast as you possibly can, then you are not using greatness as your bar for getting people into teaching. You are going back to what I said, moving bodies in and out of classrooms, which is really disruptive for students to have that constant churn of teachers.
Talking to Tim Slecker, Dean of the School of Education at Edgewood College, about issues facing teachers, schools when it comes to teacher retention, and more. Back to your calls. Kim is with us in Beaver Dam. Kim, hello.
Hi there. So I'm going to school for teaching right now. I'm a non-traditional student, so I have kind of a different perspective on it. And given all the school shootings, and I think that it's kind of a safety issue, as well as not being prepared. I taught gymnastics for 6 years, and I've got to say I learned more teaching and doing that than I have in my classroom learning.
Kim, thanks for the call. Worried about safety, rethinking being a teacher, and not feeling like she's ready. Come on.
Yeah, well, you know, and that is an issue that teacher education sometimes gets hit for. You know, are we too theoretical? We're not as practical as the classroom. But again, the solution to that is partnering, and I think it's one of the things we do incredibly well at Edgewood. We work hand in hand, and we're not alone in this. The idea that our students working with teachers, working with principals, what we do is in partnership with school districts to make sure that we're bridging that gap of what, when they say it's not really relevant. No, we're making sure that it's really relevant.
Thanks a lot for sharing your story, Kim. We'll go now to Bob in Fish Creek. Bob, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you think?
I've been teaching for 25 years. And one of the things that your guest brought up was autonomy, and autonomy leads to mastery, and that's what motivates teachers to do well, working with kids, developing relationships with them, getting to know the kids. You know, with our education system in Wisconsin, we have this, like, school rating number that appears on the state of Wisconsin that lets everyone know how your school locally is doing. But there's, you know, what is that based on? English scores, math scores, attendance rate, graduation rate. So everything else that your school does isn't taken into account. And this whole system obviously wasn't devised by teachers, because the people with the least amount of power in this whole equation of education are the teachers in the classroom. The people that can make the most difference in the students' lives, you know, we're not taking into account here like we should be, because we are the ones that do the work.
Bob, thanks for the call.
That was the best point right there, and I've said this many times. In fact, we have another new commission now that's going to go out, and there's not a teacher on it. The idea, ask any teacher about the conditions in which they're teaching, and they will tell you, I would have never designed anything that looks like this. So why would we not include teachers in policy decisions and discussions? Why? Is because we don't want their voice there.
Time for one more call. Thanks, Bob. Bridget is with us in Milwaukee. Bridget, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to speak to the issue of evaluating teachers and what makes a great teacher. Currently, we have the Danielson framework, which is used to evaluate teachers, and there is a certain whippetness or something that is you cannot measure that great teachers have, the way they build relationships, the way they inspire students. And, you know, it comes in part from that autonomy and being able to do what you think is best for students that may not be part of the curriculum, but it's also something else. And one thing I wanted to share was that my experience in MPS, you know, my students in my suburban district now are doing better. Their test scores are higher. Does that make me a better teacher? No. I was actually a better teacher in MPS when I had to work much harder because my students came in with less background knowledge and experience.
Bridget, thanks for the call. 30 seconds or so, Tim, to react to that.
Exactly. I mean, this is the other thing we know about test scores. Guess what? They're absolutely predictable by your street address. Okay, and so when you talk about that, did test scores go up in a suburban community? Where do we need great teachers? Where are the issues? You know, and start looking and going, we need people who are going to go into the hardest places to teach. To do that, you need to be an awesome person, not someone who got their certification fly by night, by emergency licensing, whatever you want. You need a deep connection to the community in which you're going to teach. And so, you know, with that, I said, if we're going to get at the shortage, let's actually ask teachers why they're leaving, and then let's fix the conditions of the classroom.
Tim, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio today.
Thank you.
Tim Slecker is the Dean of the School of Education at Edgewood College in Madison and a founding member of Education Deans for Justice and Equity. He joins us to talk about teacher morale, teacher retention problems in Wisconsin schools.